You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France, in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we are in Le Puy, en Velay.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we've just left Lessec-Sévérac-l'Église, the start town with the longest name on this year's Tour de France, and we've just gone through kilometre zero, and we're driving on the course between the publicity caravan and the race, and we hope to get to Le Puy-en-Velay. Well, we will get to Le Puy-en-Velay before the riders do, and we'll watch the remainder of the stage on the TV.
It's a beautiful stage today in the Massey Sun Trial over climbs that we don't know very well, so we'll provide a little bit of running commentary of the course before we reconvene to discuss the stage. Let's do it. Driving through crowd-lined streets, Lionel, it's what we always dreamed of, wasn't it? Well, we're looking forward to this steep climb, and Francois earlier spoke to former rider Charlie Motti, didn't you, Francois? Sorry to interrupt, you're typing in the back there.
No problem. Yeah, I talked to Charlie Motti on the phone, and then I let her saw him at the start. And because actually this called the Perataya, unlike what I said yesterday, because we all say from time to time, you know what, Charlie Motti actually, when he was in charge of the Dauphiné race back in 1997, a stage to Le Puy-en-Velay actually, rode over the Perataya. And that day, apparently, Chris Bondman was in the yellow jersey of the Dauphiné and got trapped in that climb. And Motti told me it's a real trap. It's very, very steep in some sections. Start with a little bridge that's very narrow roads, tricky roads. And Motti told me if really there's a split like tomorrow with Aru, at the end of the day, Aru could find himself or anybody else 2 minutes down on the leaders. So, yeah, a very tricky day, a stage to observe. And this Perataya pass could be a key factor.
That was a bit gritty there, wasn't it?
Yeah, loads of loose stones on the surface could be, might we see the yellow jersey puncture and then everybody slow down and wait for him?
Oh. We're a kilometre from the summit of the Monte de Nave d'Aubrac, the first category climb of the day, very early in the stage. It's a tough one. It's very hard at the bottom in particular. It kind of levels out towards the top. We're in a sort of plateau here. It's absolutely stunning landscape, very green. But a narrow, narrow, windy road, very uneven road surface. It looks really hard. You come up this in the car and you think this is going to do real damage, and then you watch the race and they just ride up it. It always takes me by surprise. That quite decent crowds as well, considering how remote we are here in this part of France, but decent crowds here waving at us. They wait, a lot of the crowds wave at every vehicle that passes. It's quite tiring, isn't it, Lionel?
Well, I don't know about tiring, but I'm concentrating on driving, so I'm not waving.
I'm waving.
Yeah, the passenger has to do the waving.
It'd be rude not to, wouldn't it?
It would. The car's got a big cycling podcast sticker on the front, so we don't want to look unfriendly.
No.
Get waving.
Hi, I'm Wim Jan. I'm the RC coordinator in the Rafa Clubhouse in Amsterdam. You're listening to the cycling podcast in association with Rafa.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Well, it was very much a home match for Romain Bardet, wasn't it, today? We heard a bit of singing, chanting there from his many, many fans and admirers. There were Bardet banners all across the course. And we heard in the first part, we drove the course today, and I think we chose a good day to do that. It was absolutely spectacular, wasn't it?
Oh, it's beautiful countryside, really amazing roads, huge crowds out today. And one thing I noticed was that the crowds all seemed to be kind of regular people. There weren't loads and loads of cyclists out who'd ridden up the climbs, or possibly because this isn't necessarily a great destination for cycling type holidays. People would tend to go to the Pyrenees or the Alps. But it looked like everyone out there was having a great day in the sunshine. Obviously, it's a Sunday and it's the weekend of Bastille Day, so a lot of people were enjoying the Tour de France.
They certainly were, and we were too, and we watched the finale to the stage once we got back to the press room, saw the drama, really. Lionel, would you like to give us a tale of the etape?
I would, yeah. We're actually just sitting outside our little hotel, the Auberge du Soleil. I'd say it's got a rustic charm that belongs in perhaps the mid to late 1970s, but it's perfectly functional, and it's a big improvement on last night's premier class on a trading estate on the outskirts of Rodez. I'm particularly interested by the butchers next door, yes, which is promising country sausages.
Yeah, and caillettes. You know what caillette is?
No, tell me.
Yeah, you'll find tomorrow. So it's kind of pâté. It's absolutely excellent. Once again, you know, that's cholesterol.
Well, I think I've seen that on the menu in here this evening. We may well be eating some of that very shortly.
Caillette is excellent stuff.
I'm still feeling a bit under the weather and slightly off my food, which is very, very unlike me and terrible. Terrible to be. You know,
save your strength for caillette tomorrow. It's pâté with herbs inside. It's very tasty, very fat, excellent.
Well, excellent. Well, stage 15 of the Tour de France from Les Secs Sévérac L'Église to Le Puy-en-Velay certainly caught me by surprise. There were two first category climbs on the route, but they were really gnarly, twisty, narrow. This first road, particularly rough road surface. We commented when we were driving the course about how gravelly the road surfaces were, and I suppose the two big stories of the day, one was the stage winner Bauke Mollema of Trek Segafredo, the Dutch rider. It was a really impressive performance by Mollema because he went away from the group. I mean, it was one of those days where everything was happening all day. There were breaks, the brakes split down and came back together again, split down, came back together again, and then Mollema seized his moment with 30 kilometres to go and really time trialled in a quite a rocking style to the finish, and looked very impressive. It reminded me of the way he won the San Sebastian Classic last year just after the Tour de France. Of course, this time last year, going into the second rest day, he was second overall behind Chris Froome. He had two bad days in the Alps and ended up finishing outside the top 10, but he's not been in GC contention here. He rode the Giro earlier this season and finished seventh, and today he picked his day. He was wearing his skin suit, he had his deep section rims on his his wheels, and he pretty much time trialed away from everybody else. And chasing him were Diego Ulissi, Tony Galopin, Primoz Roglic. They were in the group behind. Warren Barguil again in the attack, again hoovering up points for the King of the Mountains, arguably the most impressive rider of the race that's not taking part in the GC. There was the drama of Chris Froome. I speculated about the possibility of punctures, but actually he had a problem with his rear wheel. It was a broken spoke. His teammate Michał Kwiatkowski gave him a rear wheel and a shove, and then there was this kind of moment of drama. What will Mikel Landa, the teammate, do up the road? Well, Mikel Landa dropped back and helped Chris Froome join the group of favourites. The other man of the day, I have to say, Daniel Martin, a fantastic little attack at the end, gaining another 14 seconds. He's now only 1 minute 12 behind, and when you bear in mind he lost 1 minute 15 in the crash on the descent to Chambéry last Sunday, that is incredibly impressive. He's riding very well, and if he carries on at this rate of gain, he could be on the podium in Paris. Nairo Quintana, not a good day, lost almost 4 minutes. That climb really didn't suit him. A couple of other people to mention. Dan McClay, he's really suffering. He finished last today, and I believe he's now the Lanterne Rouge last man overall. He was 12 minutes behind the rider in front of him on the route today. He has a much-needed rest day tomorrow. And the Lotto Soudal rider, Tim Wellens, is out of the race. It was reported in L'Equipe that he had declined to apply for a TUE, a therapeutic use exemption, to use a medication to treat an allergy. Well, he's pulled out of the race today. None of the jerseys have changed hands today. And as I say, rest day tomorrow, and then the race resumes on Tuesday.
Some speculation this morning that Sunweb might really drive things on the front today to try and eliminate Marcel Kittel, because today was not a classified as a mountain stage. It was so the time limit was slightly less generous, and that didn't happen. It was a very aggressive day's racing and exciting, and I think that did take us by surprise. We were talking about the likes of Greg Van Avermaet as a potential winner today, but it was maybe just a little bit too hard for that type of rider, and the sort of rider we saw at the front, Warrior, your Bauke Mollemas and your Warren Barguil's. And it was a tremendous win by Bauke Mollema. He's a very nice guy. He featured last year in a commentary we did called Book Club about the big readers on the tour. He is a big reader, and I'm not going to make the joke that I made last year about his name sounding a little bit like Book, but he does read a lot of books at the tour, which makes him quite unusual. And he's an interesting guy to interview and chat to. So yeah, he doesn't win a lot of races, as you say. Won San Sebastian last year, and that was a very, very, very good win today. But what interested me afterwards in the press conference was that he talked about whether he might be tempted to become a sort of stage hunter, a bit like Warren Barguil. The way that he's ridden this tour has been to focus on stage rather than GC. He said absolutely not. No, he's a GC rider. He enjoys trying over 3 weeks to finish as high as possible, and he wants to come back. The Giro didn't suit him. He didn't like the Giro, didn't think he did well there. He wants to come back to the tour and ride for GC, which is interesting. I don't know what his contract situation is with Trek Segafredo, but Alberto Contador will still be there next year, and you imagine would target the Tour de France again. Who knows? I don't know how that will work out between them. But I actually spoke to the general manager of Trek Segafredo, Luca Guercellina, at the finish. We passed him in the car. He was wrecking the course ahead of the race. And here's what Luca Guercellina had to say at the finish.
This was a stage that you obviously knew about, but did you know the climbs? Had you wrecked this stage?
No, we didn't wreck, but we got some videos and some pictures from that, so we can explain to the riders in the morning. And then, as is common news right now for all the teams, we have a car in front, in which I was this, today, to give all the exacting indication to the car. Let's say that clearly it's almost impossible to cover all the stages. As everybody knows, we love to ride with the heart, not just with numbers and videos and so on. And that's, I think today we really proved that.
I think we saw you in the car out front. I mean, did it take you by surprise, the stage? We know that the roads here are difficult, but it was very, very technical.
Yes, I have to say that was technical, and I was surprised of the steepness of a couple of climbs that from the stage profile and altimetry doesn't look that difficult, but then they were really steep. And I think that's helped us because we gave the right indication, and at the end it was working.
And how is Alberto?
He's okay. I mean, day by day, you know, the problem of the crashes is slowly gone. Morale is a bit back. The condition too. As we all know, he need to live day by day, see what he can do to be in the top 10, clearly to see if there's a possibility to win a stage.
Is that his goal now, top 10, or will we see something spectacular from him maybe in the Alps?
Clearly, a stage win for riders like him is worth more than just being top 10. But we have not to forget that top 10 for the teams is always important. So we try to balance the two expectations and see if we can catch both, obviously. But for the most, we will make an analysis when we arrive in the Alps.
Well, before we carry on, Richard, our friend and photographer Simon Gill has rejoined us after a week's holiday. He'll be seeing us through to Marseille. He's inside our little restaurant here, and he's just sent a text message with a photo of our starter, which has arrived on the table. It looks, well, there's some pâté, it looks meaty, it looks like there's some potatoes and cheese, egg, a cornichon, it looks rich and quite heavy, but
we should probably go and eat it and then come back and do the final part of the podcast.
Well,
but anything to add on Bauke Mollema?
Maybe, if you remember, dear listeners, well, I'm talking like Ciro a little bit now. If you remember, dear listeners, the beginning of the tour, we pointed out at one stage that very quickly into the tour, some of the would-be favourites like Bauke Mollema, Robert Gesink, Warren Barguil, Thibaut Pinot, Pierre Roland, had, you know, on purpose lost time to go for stage wins. Well, for some of them, it worked. For Barguil and for Bauke Mollema, obviously, the tactics paid. And, well, it's not entirely new, but it's kind of becoming a habit. You have the GC contenders, you have the sprinters, and you have a third category of riders emerging in Grand Tours, the ones who could be GC contenders in other circumstances, that would decide on that given Grand Tour to go for a stage win. And obviously for Mollema it paid off, because remember all these tours, all these Grand Tours he rode for GC positions, all very often finishing in the top 10, but never winning anything. Which is, so I think that maybe it's kind of a sound policy to go for stage wins when you actually don't go for GC. So once again, great performance by Mollema. I didn't expect him to hold, because I mean the riders in the leading group with him were Tony Galopin, Warren Barguil, all the guys. I mean, really good riders. Quite an extraordinary performance, actually, by Bauke.
Just lastly on the stage today, a couple of other things to mention. BMC's Damiano Caruso, who I think was one of the riders you mentioned.
Yeah, I mentioned yesterday. I went in the end for Alessandro De Marchi, but I'd said Caruso, because actually Caruso has been doing a great tour so far. He was in the top 20 for a long time. I don't know where he stands now in the overall, but I mean he's been an actor in this tour, and he was there again. Yeah,
but they had three riders BMC in that up the road: Nicolas Roach, Damiano Caruso, and Amel Monar. But I just also wanted to mention, not just on the stage, because coming into the finish, Michael Matthews, who won, what day? That was yesterday, wasn't it? It feels like ages ago, but it was actually only yesterday. Perhaps that indicates I've found the last 24 hours a bit of a struggle. It feels like a long while ago that Matthews won. But today, coming into the finish straight, he was really sprinting to get to the line, and he mustn't have known that he was sprinting for 16th place when the points finished at 15th.
Yeah, he talked about it. I saw him at the bus, and he said that he went for the intermediate sprint today, not knowing how many points he'd score. And he went for the sprint today because, I mean, every little bit of points he can take off Kittel will be, because once again we have quite leisurely stage to Romans-sur-Isère on Tuesday, and then it's straight to the Alps, where on from what we've seen of Kittel in the Pyrenees, could be another struggle for him. So maybe the battle for the green jersey is not over. And obviously Matthews said he was really enjoying this tour, enjoying himself, and it's going to give Kittel a hard time until the finish. Maybe a quick one on Tim Wellens, because he gave up today, and I saw him at the start this morning. And he's a very nice guy and a very gifted young rider. Tim Wellens, probably a great, great hope for Belgian cycling, especially in the classics and shorter stage races in the future. He looked miserable. He was very polite. He told me that he was hoping to make it to Paris if his condition improved. But what the problem is with him is that he has allergies to the legs when it's hot. He's got all these spots covering his legs, and it's itching apparently terribly. Richard, you mentioned Robert Miller.
David Miller had that same
type of problem. So, yes, he looked really, eager to start and finish the race. Unfortunately, and so as you said, I asked him about the TEU and said so, and he confirmed that the team doctor told him, if we give you corticoids, the allergies might go away. And he said, well, we discussed it, and I decided that it wasn't good to use those in competition, and he preferred to abandon the Tour de France before the rest day than take than going for a TEU, which is kind of a lesson to a number of riders, and proves that some of these new generation guys have ethics.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can get 20% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com. Enter the code CPOD20 for 20% off. So we're replenished, we've eaten, we're fueled and ready to go. The other talking point today was Chris Froome's incident at the bottom of the climb. A very tough climb it was. As we said earlier, we drove over it. And he had quite a... a chase to get back on. AG2R were riding hard at the front. I don't think there were any complaints about that. The race was on. This was every important stage in this tour seems to be some kind of AG2R home fixture, doesn't it? Last week in Chambéry, that's where the team is based. Today is really Romain Bardet's backyard, and they put on a good show and sets up the final week very nicely. I mean, Froome had a bit of a struggle to get back on, but Dan Martin actually said at the finish that he didn't think any other rider could have got back on at that moment, which suggests that Froome is acknowledged as the strongest man in the race, and he's looking a little bit stronger, I think, as the race goes on.
Well, he said as much in the press conference afterwards, didn't he? He said that he had a bad day in the Pyrenees, and he feels like he's getting stronger as the race goes on. And of course, with the Alps, which are really his home territory in the sense, in the Tour de France sense at least, he must be feeling fairly confident. But he did say that he feels a bit under pressure, and that's because the time gaps are so small, and there's not going to be quite, you know, there aren't all that many opportunities to turn the screw. But then the question really is, does he need to turn the screw with that final time trial in Marseille? It's only 22 kilometres, but he could take a fair bit of time from all of those riders around him on GC. You couldn't imagine that Aru, Bardet or Uran could finish ahead of him even in the stage, could you?
You mean in the time trial?
Yeah.
Just Uran is the one threat, I think.
That's the main threat. Well, we'll have plenty of time to talk about this time trial until we reach Marseille. But obviously, it's a place I know well. I know the course like the palm of my hand. I've done it many, many, many times, even by bike. It's
being officially called the Étape François Thomas.
we had that confirmed by an ASO official this evening, didn't we? I think that was a confirmation.
Yeah, but it's a tricky. It'll be a very tricky time trial if the wind is blowing. You know, the Mistral, as we call it. If there's Mistral, it could be a very tricky stage, and once again, it will require lots of different type of qualities, not only, you know, time trial qualities, but there's a pretty steep little hill in the middle of it, and a very tricky descent as well, in which Michael Rasmussen would have crashed four times, and you know, lots of very different. That if there's wind, that they're going up and down the same road by promenade by the sea, meaning that there'll be tailwind, headwind. It could be very technical and tricky, and on that kind of tricky parcours, as far as I can see, Chris Froome is probably the best rider, the best. So it's interesting. This morning, Warren Barguil was talking about the stages in the Alps and how he was going to go for the KOM points, and he was actually saying that for him the key stage would be Serre Chevalier. He thinks that it could be movement, attacks, and everything, whereas Izoar, he said, it'll be, you know, all the favourites will control. They'll finish more or less together. Maybe the strongest will attack, you know, like 1K from the finish and earn 25 or 30 seconds. So he was kind of saying that Izoar will probably not be. The name is prestigious. The climb is fantastic, but all the GC contenders that day, we can name them, you know, and we know who they are now: Chris Froome, Romain Bardet, Fabio Aru, Rigoberto Urán, and Dan Martin should all finish pretty close to one another. So maybe the stage to look forward to is not the top of Izoard, but it's probably Wednesday's stage to Serre Chevalier.
Well, on Dan Martin, I mean, Dan Martin has been hugely impressive. He lost about, as you said, Lionel, 1 minute 15, 1 minute 14 in the crash on the stage to Chambéry. He's been chipping away at that. Now, he wouldn't have been allowed away, he said so himself at the finish, that he was allowed, in inverted commas, away because he's not one of those top, you know, a guy within sort of seconds of the jersey, so they can cut him a little bit of slack, and he did claim a few seconds back today, but he's riding very well, and more than that, he comes across as somebody who is enjoying himself, and he's very relaxed and very chatty at the end of stages. Here he is talking at the end of today's stage. After this, we'll hear from his sports director, Brian Holm, at Quickstep Floors. They, of course, also have Marcel Kittel in the green jersey. And, you know, they've got a lot on their plate. And now they've got a rider gunning for the podium in Dan Martin. So here they are, Dan Martin and Brian Holm.
I very rarely make a plan, you know, it's just opportunities. When Simon attacked on the Yates, attacked on the climb, I saw everybody was on the limit, and after the downhill, everybody kind of stalled. So I was a bit afraid because there were so many teammates left, because obviously one Adrian Zaire guy, and Lando was there for Chris, and I thought, I knew it was a lot of downhills to the finish, so I just, if I got a gap, it'd be difficult to come back. Took advantage of the opportunity and just saw the opening and went, take it day by day. And just, I think normally you see bigger gaps in the final week. I'm sure it's not going to be 1 minute between the top six in Paris, so we'll just keep concentrated and keep focused, and hopefully it's not me that has a bad day. I think we've been nipping away time every day this week, so it's just taking advantage of the situation, I was saying. Just, I learned the hard way last year that every second counts at the Tour, by obviously being 6 seconds there off 7th place on DC and being ninth. So.
I mean, he looked like bonkers after his crash, you know. I mean, most guys would probably end up sort of in the hospital or something a few weeks. But he really looked quite bad, you know, he couldn't hardly walk. And he said, I come back. And every day he said, like, getting 0.5% better. And so he did. And of course, maybe not going to change the world, what he did today, but it's very good for his head to know he can do it. We always said, let him survive here in the Pyrenees, you know, let him just not lose too much. If he was still hanging, to be honest, I thought he would lose 1 minute, you know, hanging about top 10. He didn't. He always kept faith, Dan, and he said, let me just survive here and then I get better in the Alps. So we crossed our fingers, and I think we all know, not because anybody bothered, but I think without his crash, he would have been pretty close in the GC. And even just to know it, I know that's cycling, that's what happened with crashes or wheel, father, but it's good for his head also to know it. You saw last year, you know, you saw when he was in Dauphiné third with 1 second, last year Catalonia with 1 second, so it was always about seconds for us, you know. Last year, I think from number 7 to 11 was like within 1 minute or something like that. So we were prepared, like every second would count, and of course it was like sort of a pity when he crashed, you know, lost 1 minute 17, though. So it would be hard to catch back because it could be very, very close, but it seems like then he really got the spirit to do it, and he get better now.
He's chipping away at the lead. The momentum seems to be with him a little bit. You know, what's realistic for him over the next week?
Oh, we started with the idea ending on the podium. I think we could aim high for that. And I think he proved already he can do it. And of course, we know already if he would have been second in the GC today, maybe they would not let him go in the finals. So that's, of course, when you 1 minute something behind us, make it a little bit easier also.
But you've got, you know, a podium contender, you've got a guy in green. How does the team support both those riders?
Today we divided it. Our biggest worries was like to hang with Marcel off day, but he was flying today. He could almost support Dan. But in the final, you know, okay, Dan was alone, but like 80% of everybody in the front was alone in the final, you know. Gilbert stayed there, Juan Vila got a day off, and everybody support him to the last, 30 kilometers and then on his own, but that's no big surprise. I mean, we don't have a Sky team or a Sudosar team, they're doing a good job, but they're keeping up the wind, Jack Bauer and those guys into the final, so he save energy, and then he left on his own and he do it pretty good.
So that was Brian Holm, and before that we heard a little bit from Dan Martin. At this point I should mention that tomorrow, Monday, on the rest day, we are releasing an episode for friends of the podcast. It's not a friends special. We release 11 friends specials. They're a little bit special. This is a sort of pulling the curtain back on our trip around Germany, Belgium and France.
Yeah, the disclaimer is it contains very little cycling content.
Very little, but it does... Well, that's not actually strictly true, because we get some fascinating insight from Francois into what it was like to cover the tour back in the days before the internet and Twitter and social media and you know, running into Stephen
podcasts. I mean, before podcasts, if ever such a day existed.
But you know, the days when bumping into Stephen Roach in a petrol station got you a scoop that then your rivals were chasing for literally hours. So it's really, there's some interesting stuff. It'll be released on Monday. Sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. By doing so, you support us throughout the year and you help us to cover the three Grand Tours in this way with daily coverage. So thank you very much to everybody who's signed up and to all those who've signed up during the tour. I think we've got a few new listeners, so very much appreciate that. And it's £10 for the year, thecyclingpodcast.com. And what's the other business for today? I mean, Chris Froome and Team Sky had a little test today, and it reminds you that, and you obviously mentioned that these roads were hazardous and there was a threat of punctures with the stones and so on, but it does remind you that if anything was to happen, there are riders and teams who are there and perhaps will be able to take advantage.
Well, we've been looking for cracks in Team Sky's harmony, haven't we? I mean, that's kind of what we always do. Richard, you made a very good point that a lot of the drama in the Tour de France tends to come when there are two strong riders in one team rather than all the rivals being spread amongst other teams, because then the incentive is for them all to kind of, you know, collaborate together, really, because they're all, you know, so much of a muchness, and there's more to lose from attacking than there is possibly to gain. Whereas when you've got two strong riders in the same team, you know, the gloves come off and almost anything could happen. And we kind of, I suppose we do want to get the wooden spoon in and start stirring up a little bit of intrigue.
The greatest stories in the Tour have often been when you've got these, because cycling is this such a strange sport where it's a team sport practiced by individuals, ambitious individuals, and all the honour goes to an individual. I mean, Kwiatkowski, we're talking about him today, he has been absolutely outstanding for Team Sky. Milan Sanremo winner, former world champion, one of the best riders in the world, has completely sacrificed himself for Chris Froome and Team Sky. And getting him to do that
takes an awful lot of money.
That's what I was about to say.
So cynical. He just wants Chris Froome to win the Tour de France, Lionel.
Of course, but it's the same as a top football team having you know multi-millionaire, really valuable players sitting on the bench, knowing that they're going to play a different role. They're not necessarily going to start every game. That's not a great analogy because
he's starting every game,
and what he has to do is difficult work. I mean, hard work day after day. But Team Sky today played an absolute blinder. We've been a little bit critical of Sergio Henao earlier in the tour for going missing at key moments, but he was looking better today. Kwiatkowski, I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better teammate than him today. And Mikel Landa, when he could have had the opportunity to pretend his radio wasn't working or not appreciate the situation with Chris Froome and perhaps just ride for his own ambitions and perhaps, who knows, go and gain some time.
Go rogue.
You just never know. He chose not to.
Yeah, I was about to say the radio obviously worked well and the figures were high enough because he dropped back. But it's true. I mean, the way they played, the teamwork played was a little bit difficult to understand in the first when we watched it, because when he was dropped, we saw clearly Chris Froome tell Mikel Nieve to go front, which seemed a little bit strange, you know, for a guy who's dropped. But then there are two guys in the front, Landa and Nieve, and then two guys with him, and it was probably the wise thing to do. And it proved what cold blood at that very moment, and probably experience and confidence in his means. Chris Froome had to decide to tell Nieve, no, don't stay with me. Go ahead. We'll see you later on. When I talked to Dave Brailsford about it, he tried to explain what kind of a tactic.
Well, shall
it was.
We hear a little bit from Dave Brailsford?
Yeah, he's probably going to explain it better than me.
During the stage, we saw that Chris told Mikel to go ahead when he had his mechanical. And what was the plan at that moment? Why did he do that?
Yeah, I don't know. You'd have to ask him what was going through his head and what he was saying. I can only assume that he did the right thing, which was to tell Mikel to stay in the front group, you know, as a GC rider. And then obviously when he's changed his wheel and got back on, then he would have somebody in the front group. So I'm assuming that's what he said. I don't know what he said.
Which apparently means he had trust in himself that he was able to make it back, maybe not on his own, but with only Sergio and Basile.
Again, you'd have to ask him. But he's experienced now, isn't he? And I think he's got that degree of calmness. He doesn't panic. And so he doesn't overexert himself too quickly. And I think he can gauge his effort. He knew he had 30, 35K to go, and he
he knows how to gauge his efforts over a distance like that. I think he knew the steep part, the steep climb was coming up, and that was the moment really where they could claw them back. And I think with Sergio and Nieve, I think he was very fortunate to have those two guys there. And of course with I think he probably will give Mikkel Kwiatkowski another pat on the back, but for his mechanicking skills rather than his riding for once, which would be well deserved, I think.
And with all the first word about Landa and Chris the previous day, we saw that when he needed Landa, came back and waited for Chris, sort of.
Well, I think the fuss comes from everybody else, maybe, not from us. We got total confidence I think when you've got two guys like that, you can kind of sense whether there's trust. And fundamentally, if there's trust, you're in a good position. And if that trust is lacking a little bit, then you're in a bit more of a difficult situation, because you're always going to second guess or maybe ask yourself twice what's going to happen. But Mikko was the perfect teammate again today, and was very important that he was there and just dropped off. For that last 5-10 seconds when Chris was coming back, he just dropped back. And I think psychologically, to see one of your own team there and just being able to get him, guide up, and then to have somebody in the final there just to help ride, was couldn't have asked for better, and well played, Mikko Landa, once again.
Lots of people say Chris shows weaknesses in this tour, but we have the impression he also shows strengths, actually, in the key moments.
Yeah, you couldn't do what he did today unless he was strong. I think, but they were going in the front there today, and to come back to that group, and when he dropped, when Mikkel Nieve had done his job and he rode back to the front group, that was impressive, to be fair to him.
So that was Francois talking to Dave Brailsford. We should wrap things up here, but we've got the rest day to look forward to tomorrow. Just on the that what you were saying earlier, Lionel, about the intrigue when you've got two strong riders in one team. The problem with the Tour de France, and Guercellina said it earlier when talking about Contador, a rider like Contador who's won the Tour, won many Grand Tours, there's a lot of pressure on him. I got the sense there's pressure on him within the team to consolidate a top 10 finish overall rather than go for stage wins, because the team needs the points from a top 10 overall finish, and there are a lot of points available for riders who finish in the top 10. And Louis Mencius, for example, a top 10 finish for his team UAE would be enormously valuable. Now, speaking of value, here's a little table that I've been sent tonight. Who do you think are the biggest prize winners so far on the tour? Who's won the most money?
I would say Quickstep.
Correct. Who's won the least?
Oh, I would say Bahrain.
Absolutely right, Lionel. 100% record, yeah. A measly €3,110 for Bahrain Marina.
Well, they've done absolutely
nothing. That's half as much as Cofidis.
Wow. So yeah, but Cofidis get €2,000 just for being French.
Surprising. The third worst performing team in terms of prize money is Orica Scott.
Really?
And the fourth worst is Movistar.
Mm.
Wow.
So those two teams, I mean, that's surprising because Simon Yates is obviously in the white jersey and riding well. But
the prize money is skewed quite strangely, isn't it, I suppose? Mm. I don't think you get an awful lot for having the white jersey day after day, whereas you get a lot for stage wins. Yeah, interesting.
I am delighted to see, the top prize money winner so far, Quickstep, with €84,460. Team Sunweb second, €58,000. Team Sky third. Delighted to see Wanty Group Gobert up there in sixth, and that shows that attacking all the time, as they have been doing, can pay off. They've done pretty well so far.
Well, we had Wimbledon final, the Wimbledon final today, and when you compare the figures that Roger Federer is going to win for his umpteenth Wimbledon victory to what these teams get, you understand that the tour is not about prize money. It's more about what you make of the prestige of winning the tour or being seen on the tour, and the big money will come later, in publicity, UCI points, other races, sponsors, everything. But the tour is probably the biggest sports event in the world that pays so bad.
Yeah, that's probably true. Listen, we should wrap things up there and look forward to our rest day tomorrow. As I said earlier, we do have an episode coming out tomorrow for friends of the podcast. Do sign up for that.
We also have a Kilometre Zero, Richard. Don't forget that. Looking ahead to La Course, the two-day women's race that will be happening on the Côte d'Ivoire.
Thursday and Saturday.
And in Marseille. An interesting new format. And tomorrow's Kilometre Zero is called, quite simply, La Course.
And we've spoken to quite a lot of the top female riders about that, about what they're anticipating, whether they're looking forward to it, whether they think it's a positive step away from the traditional La Course in Paris. So yeah, listen out for that. And we'll be back on Tuesday. For the meantime, thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Let's go and see if there's some dessert.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you, Richard.